Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday the 3rd of July, these are our main stories. Japan's Supreme Court rules that thousands of disabled people who were forcibly sterilised can claim compensation. With more than 120 people now said to have been crushed to death at a religious gathering in India, could more have been done to save them? The United Nations says aid sent to the people of Sudan has been looted on an industrial scale by the warring parties. Also in this podcast, a mother says she killed her terminally ill 7-year-old son to end his suffering.
I said, "Would you like me to remove the pain?" And he said, "Yes, please, Mama." I gave him a large dose of morphine.
Now the controversy over the eSports World Cup in Saudi Arabia. Yumi Suzuki was born with cerebral palsy. When she was just 12 years old, she was forcibly sterilised under a Japanese eugenics law which saw thousands of people sterilised against their will for decades until as recently as the 1990s. Now, at the age of 68, she has finally received a measure of justice. In a landmark ruling, the Japanese Supreme Court has ordered the government to pay compensation to her and 10 other plaintiffs. Here she is speaking to the BBC in 2021.
When I found out, I realised I could never be a mother. It broke my heart. I faced discrimination from when I was small, but this was very different. I don't want money. I want people to know what happened to us, to make sure it never happens again. I want people with disabilities to be treated equally. We're not things. We're human beings.
The court has also ruled that Japan's 20-year statute of limitations does not apply in such cases, paving the way for many more people to seek redress. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow, told us more.
I think it's first of all worthwhile looking at a little bit of a background, because it's a complicated case. As you mentioned there, it's about a terrible eugenics policy, discredited policy, which was in force in Japan between 1948 and 1996. In that period, 16,000 people were forcibly sterilised against their will. These were people with mental illnesses, hereditary diseases, sometimes even just intellectually limited. And sometimes they went into, say, orphanages or things like that. All these people were sterilised. Another 8,000 actually were sterilised, it's thought, because they were forced into making this decision. So we're looking at about 25,000 people. A couple of years ago, someone brought a case against the government because of this. The government apologised, offered some compensation, but a lot of people thought this wasn't enough and they pursued more compensation through the courts. The problem was there's a 20-year statute of limitations in Japan, so a lot of these cases are just too old. And so the Supreme Court, what it was doing was ruling on whether or not these cases were too old or whether plaintiffs could pursue them through the courts.
And it's been quite a lengthy battle, this, and we're talking about people, some of them, who were just teenagers when they were sterilised.
Yeah, teenagers, some very, very terrible stories. One man, I've just seen a report about it, he was sent to a home for troubled children when he was 14. He had a vasectomy, he was forced to have a vasectomy. He didn't tell his wife for decades and decades until she was on her deathbed. We have all those kinds of terrible stories. What the court has ruled today is that these people can pursue their cases through the courts, claim extra compensation. This is something, by the way, the Japanese government tried to resist to stop them pursuing their cases through the courts. And so now it's probably assumed that a lot of cases in the lower courts or cases people are waiting to start will now start running through the courts and people will be able to claim compensation and, more importantly, explain what went on in their lives, what happened to them, and, you know, how to seek redress for these terrible, terrible things.
Michael Bristow. Now to India and to the latest in a story you heard in our last podcast. Survivors of the country's deadliest stampede in more than a decade have been describing how the religious gathering they were attending turned into a scene of panic and then death. More than 120 people are said to have been crushed to death at the prayer meeting in the northern Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. Nearly all the victims were women. Those trying to save them questioned why the authorities hadn't done more to help.
Some were breathing, some were not. They were in a terrible condition. We poured water on some who were breathing, made them drink water and wiped their mouths. There was no arrangement for ambulances here. An ambulance came later. We stopped cars and transported the patients to the hospital.
Where are the authorities? No official is present here.
Police say the marquee where the event was being held was massively overcrowded, with 250,000 people crammed into a venue which only had permission to host 80,000. The police say they want to question the religious leader of the event. Our South Asia regional editor, Ambarasan Rajan, is at the scene of the disaster in Uttar Pradesh.
Still, we see dozens of people around this site, outside near the town of Hathras, and I see people removing their tent, their marquee which they had put up, and a lot of policemen, forensic department people, they were all there this morning. Political leaders were visiting to find out what had happened. There is a big arch entrance with the photograph of the self-styled godman. It is still there, and it's raining, so the whole area has been flooded with water. Now I'm near the drain where most of these women died. You know, people brought snacks to eat during this prayer meeting, plastic cups, water cups, some clothes here, and then also paper plates and slippers strewn around all over the place. And this is the drain across the road where a majority of these people died. Now, police have launched an investigation. They are now want to question those who organized this event. There were tens of thousands of people. As you said, they were given permission only to have 80,000. So how this was allowed to happen, and also find out whether there is any lapses by the civil administration here. And these are some of the areas the authorities want to look at.
And what have survivors there been saying to you?
I've been speaking to a couple of people who survived this event, and also one, Hirdesh Kumar. He lost his wife, unfortunately. And what he said was women were all on the one side and the men were on the other side. And these young kids were sitting with the men. And nothing happened to those kids, but then his wife unfortunately died. He said when the people were moving out and they wanted to have a glimpse of this self-styled Bole Baba, and they wanted to take the soil underneath the tire of his car because it's supposed to be a blessing. So women were really coming across the road. And that's when the whole thing happened, fell into this drain around here. So another person, he was saying he was still looking for his aunt. His aunt has been missing since yesterday, and he went to 4 or 5 hospitals, could not find any body or even on the injured list. So the number of casualties is much, much higher than what officials are saying, because many villagers told me here, just nearby, they said did not want to go through the process of post-mortem, say they took the bodies away. So we don't know the real casualty figure, even though the official figure stands around 120.
Ambarasan Etirajan. As we record this podcast, Israeli forces are continuing to battle Hamas and Islamic Jihad fighters in a district of Gaza City, as tens of thousands of Palestinians further south continue to try to find a safe location after fleeing areas of Khan Yunis in response to an Israeli evacuation order issued on Monday. Explosions, shelling and gunfire have been heard throughout Gaza City. The Israeli army says it's carrying out operations throughout the territory. Meanwhile, Palestinians in southern Gaza continue their desperate search for somewhere to shelter. Louise Waterbridge is an official with the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA.
In Nusayriya, where I am, which is somewhat by the coast, there are makeshift tents, makeshift shelters up to the waterline. As the water is coming in from the sea, people are on the beach, families are on the beach, they are shelter to shelter. There is absolutely no space for people to move here. And from Khan Yunis, they're already leaving these bombed out and rubble-filled buildings that are very structurally unsafe.
Israel has designated the region of Al-Mawasi as a safe zone. Marwan Isbatia has moved from Khan Yunis with his family to Al-Mawasi. He told the BBC about his journey.
We live in a rush, so we couldn't get all of our luggage and important things. Any Gazan who is being displaced 2, 3, 4 times like me has his own tent. I previously purchased one, and it was with me. So I called a friend who resides in Almawasi. He told me there is a place next to me, you can come. Then I went there to Almawasi. It took from my location around 3 hours. My wife is currently pregnant, and she could deliver maybe after one month. We have to protect her, you know, very well, and she shouldn't be tired or exhausted.
But reports say an Israeli airstrike killed 12 Palestinians in Almawasi on Tuesday, despite the fact that it has been designated as a safe zone by Israel. Our Jerusalem correspondent, Yoland Nell, told us more.
These Palestinians have been fleeing from the eastern part of Khan Yunis in droves, continuing overnight. They've described there's been an intense bombardment around Khan Yunis, some of the heaviest fighting in that second biggest city in the Gaza Strip since Israeli troops withdrew there in early April. There's one hospital source that said shelling killed at least 8 people. And people have been really heading west, some to other parts of Khan Yunis, and many more to this area, which the Israeli military has declared a safe zone along the coast, the Almawasi area. It's about 14 kilometres long, but of course people are struggling to find space there. The reason that Khan Yunis had become so crowded after it was largely left in ruins following that months-long Israeli military offensive there against what the Israeli military said was a stronghold of Hamas earlier in the war. We had, since May, people fleeing from Rafah in the very south of the Gaza Strip. That's where most of the displaced people in Gaza had ended up, along the Egyptian border. When Israel's military offensive started there, many people went to Khan Yunis. Some had already gone to Almawasi, so that's why it's very difficult now for people to find a place even to put up a makeshift tent in this area along the coast. And we're hearing of just dire humanitarian conditions in this area, lacking sanitation, lacking any kinds of medical facilities, very, very limited access to aid.
Yes, given all that, how are people coping? Because we're hearing reports that some of the tents are camped right down to the sea. People are struggling to get food. How are they disposing of their waste?
The water supplies there are often contaminated by sewage. There are these mountains of rubbish because the local authorities really are just overwhelmed by the situation. I mean, the amount of food that has been entering into the southern part of the Gaza Strip, where most displaced Palestinians are, has really dropped very dramatically since the Rafah offensive began. And the UN has been saying that the general lawlessness now in the south, which allows criminal gangs to loot lorry loads of aid, it is making it extremely difficult to collect the aid from the Kerem Shalom crossing, which is the main one between Israel and Gaza, and then distribute it to those people who are desperately in need.
Yoland Nell. Here in Britain, people are preparing to vote in what looks likely to be a historic election on Thursday. One major concern is immigration, both illegal and legal. Since the Conservatives came to power 14 years ago, total net migration, that's the difference between those arriving in and leaving the country, has reached just under 4.5 million people. The two main parties, the Conservatives and Labour, say net migration is too high and should be reduced, but they haven't given a figure. The anti-immigration populist Reform Party says it should be reduced to zero. Our political correspondent Rob Watson reports.
Good morning. What would you like for breakfast
this morning, Carly? This is the Alexander Care Home in Morley, just outside Leeds in the north of England.
And you would like some cornflakes?
Okay, Mel. It's breakfast time. I'm with the care home's owner, Alex Morris. Now, the person serving breakfast, I definitely detected a Yorkshire accent there, but many of your staff are migrants. How vital are they to your business?
Oh, well, they're absolutely vital. 40% of our staff were born abroad. And it's not just bums on seats. They want to work and they want to look after elderly people and they want to treat them with respect, and it's incredibly vital to us.
And what would happen to the social care system in this country without pretty high levels of migration?
Well, I think, not to sound overly dramatic, but I think it would essentially collapse.
Of the nearly 1.5 million visas the government issued last year, many were for people to work in places like this care home and other parts of the UK's health system, while another significant chunk were for study, the higher fees paid by foreign students keeping down the costs for British-born pupils. But if the principal argument for immigration is that Britain needs more people given its ageing population, the arguments against it include the strain higher numbers put on the country's already stretched public services. Here's the very briefest of rebuttals from Paul Johnson of the independent think tank, the Institute for Fiscal Studies.
On average, immigrants pay more tax than they use in terms of public services. They're younger than the average for the domestic population. They use the health service less and so on.
The other argument against high levels of immigration is that it strains social cohesion and the ability of an already diverse population to get along.
An MP has died after being attacked in the street in her constituency in West Yorkshire. Jo Cox was stabbed and shot...
I am in Backley, a short distance from Leeds, where in 2016 the sitting MP was murdered by a right-wing English nationalist, and where a teacher remains in hiding after showing a caricature of the Prophet Muhammad. I was here in the hours after the MP's murder 8 years ago and have come back to talk to people about social cohesion and the extent to which the white and Asian communities interact.
Definitely people live separately to a degree. It's really difficult to break down barriers and make changes because people are very much set in the ways and then they adopt how the families have always been, and I think it's just going to carry on and carry on.
I'm a great believer in when in Rome do as the Romans do, and that's not happening here. They've come into this country and they're doing their own thing when a lot of it isn't correct, it's not right.
I'm just going to pop into a chai shop here on the main street to ask the owner about what she makes of the charge from many white residents that communities live separate lives.
Not everyone is like that. I do agree that some of the people may do like this, but not everyone of us like this because we live in one community, sharing everything with each other, and there should be no differences.
It has been argued that along with stagnating living standards, concern over immigration and issues of identity and multiculturalism underlie much of Britain's recent political turbulence. So any new government wanting stability will have to make sure that not only are people better off, but that they also get along better.
That report by Rob Watson. Now, which sports championship allows you to sit while competing for prize money worth a cool $60 million? It's the Esports World Cup, which begins today. Thousands of fans of gaming can watch their favourite players compete on classics such as Call of Duty and League of Legends. The 8-week tournament is happening in Saudi Arabia, a decision not without controversy given the accusations of sports washing. Sophie McCarthy, editor-in-chief of EsportsNet, spoke to Emma Barnett.
The Esports World Cup is going to be one of the biggest esports tournaments of all time, particularly in terms of prize pool. It is an aggregate prize pool of $60 million that's going to be split among 21 different games, but it is the biggest prize pool that we've seen in any esports tournament in the last 10 years.
Are they the players sitting down and everyone else also watching sitting down? You know, the whole sofa mentality comes to mind still for a lot of people. How does it work?
It's very much not like that anymore. So these tournaments are played in enormous arenas, tens of thousands of people, and it can be equated very much to what one might call regular sports. People will be cheering. It's an incredible atmosphere. It's very much not sitting on the sofa watching somebody play video games.
But are the players standing?
No, the players are by and large sitting down, playing at the computer, on the stage, with their teams.
Are the concerns, because some do have them, serious concerns about the idea of sport washing Saudi Arabia, a place where people feel, a regime feel very strongly that shouldn't be hosting these sorts of events and shouldn't be funding them because of attitudes towards women, towards LGBT people. What do you make of that?
I think this is something that the esports industry does have to pay attention to and does have to contend with. It's a very personal matter, and I think that is something we need to take into consideration.
Sophie McCarthy, editor-in-chief of eSportsNet. Coming up on this podcast, how one of North America's largest areas of glaciers is melting faster than previously thought.
All the glaciers in the world contribute about a quarter of global sea level rise, and Alaska is the biggest contributing place. These glaciers are really important in driving sea level rise.
Hey, listeners, want to diversify your portfolio easily? The all-in-one ETFs from Fidelity Investments Canada lets you do just that. Each ETF provides exposure to stocks, bonds, and crypto so you can potentially maximize your return. It's essentially like getting a complete portfolio in one trade. Visit fidelity.ca/all-in-one and find the ETF that's right for you. Commissions, fees, and expenses may apply. Read the funds or ETFs prospectus before investing. Funds and ETFs are not guaranteed. Their values change and past performance may not be repeated.
You're listening to the Global News podcast. Let's turn now to the continuing conflict in Sudan. The UN says humanitarian agencies there have faced looting on an industrial scale since the civil war between the army and the paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, erupted more than a year ago. The UN also says starvation is being used as a weapon of war in Sudan. It's been warning of an imminent famine with 25 million people urgently needing humanitarian assistance. A senior UN official, Toby Harvard, told the BBC that hundreds of millions of dollars worth of aid had been lost.
Humanitarian partners have faced a looting on an epidemic on an industrial scale since the beginning of the conflict in April 2023. I mean, we have lost hundreds of millions of dollars worth of humanitarian assistance, offices, vehicles, equipment, etc., from a number of different UN and INGO bases across the country. But in this particular case, well, I understand what happened was unidentified gunmen took advantage of a convoy that was heading in a particular part of central Darfur that is always difficult to control, whoever are the authorities on the ground. And it appears that disaffected militias, criminals, bandits, etc., opportunistically were taking advantage of the lack of rule of law, of the lack of general governance, and stopped, in this case, three food trucks and took a number of nutritional cartons, rice and sugar. Now, obviously, this has an effect on what we do. We have to do everything we can to mitigate these risks, but we will be continuing. We have spoken with the de facto authorities on the ground, and we have said very clearly that we expect them to locate the gunmen and return the looted food. We will continue with the convoys that are going in the hope that the vast majority will reach the intended beneficiaries on the ground.
UN official Toby Harvard. As we record this podcast, Hurricane Beryl, a powerful Category 4 storm, is barreling towards Jamaica after causing devastation in smaller islands in the Eastern Caribbean. Speaking to the BBC, the island's information minister, Senator Dana Morris-Dixon, said Jamaica was well prepared.
We know we're going to be impacted, but we have a good government apparatus in order to respond to disasters. We're probably in the best position we have ever been in terms of being able to respond to a disaster. And we have put everything in place to deal with a hurricane of this strength. And, it's a big hurricane.
In St. Vincent and the Grenadines, the majority of the population of Union Island is homeless. Roads have been blocked and power cables are down. In Grenada, on two of its three islands, almost all the homes and buildings have been destroyed, as well as much of the island's vegetation. Just before we recorded this podcast, Ben Rich from the BBC Weather Unit gave us this update.
The storm is now moving quite close to Jamaica, bearing down from the southeast, still as a Category 4 hurricane, so an extremely dangerous major hurricane. The winds now really picking up across Jamaica, tropical storm strength winds already setting in, and those winds are only set to increase. So hopefully people there have now made the preparations that they will need to make, because the conditions are only going to go downhill from here. What we're expecting is for the eye to probably pass just to the south of Jamaica. So the centre of the hurricane staying just away to the south, but close enough to bring really strong, destructive winds. Sustained winds at the moment around 145 miles per hour, 230 kilometres per hour. That will couple with huge amounts of rain, perhaps 300 millimetres of rain. So that could give some significant flooding. And then on top of that, a storm surge of 2.5 metres, which could inundate low-lying coastal areas. So really dangerous weather through the coming hours.
Really dangerous and unusual.
Extremely unusual. This storm, as it moved across the Windward Islands a little bit further east, was the first Category 5 hurricane ever recorded in the Atlantic in June. So the earliest Category 5 hurricane we've seen. Now, this storm still powerful, not quite that powerful, but still really powerful as it moves its way westwards. This time of year, we tend to see the smaller hurricanes. The hurricane season runs from June through to November. It peaks in September when sea temperatures are normally at their highest. So that's when we tend to see the strongest storm. So this one very, very early in the season.
And briefly, do we know why?
Well, the main reason is those sea surface temperatures. The area of ocean that the storm has been moving across is around 2 or 3 degrees above average. And that's followed on from a pattern of very high sea temperatures right around the globe over the last year, actually. So that's probably the main reason. We've also come to the end of an El Nino. El Nino, which is a phenomenon in the Pacific, actually, tends to suppress Atlantic hurricane activity. That has now eased, so that may well open the gate to bigger hurricanes like these. We are expecting a really active Atlantic hurricane season this year.
So it seems climate change is a factor.
Well, climate change with warmer oceans, and also what climate change will do when the storms crop up, they are likely to be more powerful and bring a lot more rain. They may not be more hurricanes because of climate change, but the ones we get are likely to be more intense.
BBC weather forecaster Ben Rich. Here in Britain, a woman has admitted giving her terminally ill son a fatal dose of morphine more than 40 years ago. And Tonya Cooper says her son Hamish, who was 7 at the time, was in great pain after months of gruelling cancer treatment. She says she's decided to tell her story now in a bid to change the law on assisted dying, which is illegal in the UK. Sophie Law reports.
Hamish Cooper passed away at just 7 years old. The year was 1981. He had neuroblastoma, a rare cancer that mostly affects children. 43 years on, his mother, Antonia, has chosen to speak out about his death publicly for the first time, prompted by her own diagnosis.
I was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. One of the scans that I was having many of discovered I had secondaries in my liver. There is very much a limit on my life going forward. We don't know how long.
I wonder whether your experience with Hamish and everything that happened there, part of that has helped you be so proactive in terms of joining Dignitas, being, you know, vocal about your support for assisted dying. Do you think that experience has...
Very much so, because on Hamish's last night, when he said he was in a lot of pain, I said, would you like me to remove the pain? And he said, yes, please, Mama. Mm. And through his Hickman catheter, I gave him a large dose of morphine that did quietly end his life.
At that point in our chat, we called it a day. It was an incredible revelation, a secret she'd kept within the family for nearly 4 decades. I wanted to talk to Antonia about the part she played in her son's death in much greater detail, so we chose to come back a few weeks later.
He knew somewhere what was going to happen, but I cannot obviously tell you why or how. I was his mother, he loved his mother, and I totally loved him. And I was not going to let him suffer. And I feel he really knew where he was going.
There is theoretically a potential prison sentence.
There is.
Involved in this.
And if they come 43 years after I have allowed Hamish to die peacefully, then I would have to face the consequences. But they would have to be quick, because I'm dying too.
Antonia Cooper, ending that report by Sophie Law. A US federal judge has denied a request from prosecutors to stop rapper BG, or Baby Gangster, who's known for the 1999 signature track Bling Bling, from promoting future gun violence in his music, citing free speech concerns. But he's been required to submit his lyrics for review to ensure they align with his rehabilitation goals. BG, whose legal name is Christopher Dorsey, was given a 14-year prison sentence back in 2012 after pleading guilty to illegally possessing a gun during a 2009 traffic stop, among other linked charges. In February this year, he began a 2-year period of living under federal supervision outside jail, but came under scrutiny from probation officers after he performed at a concert in Las Vegas. For more on this, Victoria Uwankunda spoke to Ramses Jar, a hip-hop radio veteran who currently hosts the Civic Cypher, billed as the largest hip-hop radio show in America.
I recognize that the judge is playing the middle. The judge understands that there needs to be a component of free speech, but the judge also recognizes that BG's lyrics and the lifestyle that he's glorifying is inconsistent with the parameters of his parole. So she is not restricting the free speech. Rather, she's suggesting that they be submitted for review so that the prosecution can determine whether or not the lyrics are, again, consistent with the nature of his rehabilitation.
So what do you make of the fact that BG now has to submit his lyrics or text to his music for review?
He appreciates the fact that he has not been violated because he has performed and recorded with artists that are also felons, which was one of the conditions of his parole. So he's technically violated that, but he had to do that for work. I make of it personally that he's making the best of a tough situation. He's like an actor. In fact, he equated himself to Robert De Niro, saying that, you know, Robert De Niro being forced to not play a mobster would really compromise his ability to express himself through his art and to make money for his family. So my heart goes out to BG because this is the lifestyle he comes from. This is what he knows. And this is what he's known for rapping about. I'm glad that he's not going back to jail for violating his parole, but I'm also concerned that his speech is being monitored and that doesn't feel consistent with the American, you know, way of life nor the Constitution.
Hip-hop veteran Ramses Jar. One of North America's largest areas of interconnected glaciers is melting twice as quickly as it did before 2010. That's a worrying finding of a team of scientists. The Juno ice field sprawls across the coastal mountains of Alaska and British Columbia. But new research published suggests that not only is it melting twice as fast as it was less than a decade and a half ago, but it's also melting five times faster than it was in the 1980s. Bethan Davies is a senior lecturer of physical geography at Newcastle University and led this research.
We used quite a few different methods. From the 1990s onwards, we used satellite imagery. And then from the 1940s and the 1970s, we used aerial photographs. And these aerial photographs were flown in the area in the time before we had GPS satellites and GPS technology. So there's no geospatial information. They're just photographs. So we had to stitch all of those photographs together to make three-dimensional models of the ice field. And then we also looked at the imprint, the footprint of the ice field at the Little Ice Age, that period of time that was a little bit colder when glaciers were a little bit bigger. And that was about 1770 in Alaska. The problem with ice fields like this is they are sustained by their own ice volume. They're not the small mountain glaciers that we have in the European Alps that can just shrink back and then if it stops warming, they can stabilize. As the climate warms, this ice field will continue to lower. And as it lowers, it lowers into warmer air. And once it starts doing that, it's really difficult to stop it. All the glaciers in the world contribute about a quarter of global sea level rise. And Alaska is the biggest contributing place. These glaciers are really important in driving sea level rise, certainly over the next 100 years.
Scientist Bethan Davies. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Daniel Fox. The producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.